Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Laura Fraser, author of An Italian Affair and a member of the San Francisco Writers Grotto. And it's my distinct pleasure to introduce tonight's guest, Jonah Lehrer. Lehrer is a scientist, a writer, and an engaging thinker. A Rhodes Scholar, I've been told that Mr. Lehrer can frequently be found lurking around scientific laboratories when he's not writing for such publications as The New Yorker, Nature, Wired, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. He is editor-at-large for Seed Magazine, an insightful and entertaining online publication about science. He's also the best-selling author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and most recently, How We Decide. We're delighted that he's here with us tonight. Please join me now in warmly welcoming Jonah Lehrer to Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. So, Jonah, I'm going to start with the end of your book, How We Decide, because right at the end you said that you wrote this book because you couldn't figure out which kind of Cheerios to buy. So what was going on in your brain when you were trying to decide which kinds of Cheerios?
Well, this is... I got the idea for the book. I can remember the exact morning. My wife and I had recently returned from living overseas, so we were still adjusting to the surreal abundance of the American supermarket, the fact that you have 200 different types of toothpaste, 100 different types of floss. And we'd gotten all our food items, and we were at the checkout line. We put them on the conveyor belt, and that's when we remember that we'd forgotten to buy breakfast cereal. So I was sent back to the cereal aisle with relatively straightforward instructions to buy a box of Cheerios. And no sooner do I get to the cereal aisle, then I reach for the box, the yellow box of original Cheerios. Then I spot right next to that the box of Honey Nut Cheerios. And I think to myself, you know, Honey Nut Cheerios are much more delicious than regular Cheerios. So then I reach for the box of Honey Nut Cheerios, only to see right next to that a box of multigrain Cheerios. And I think, you know, I should get more fiber in my diet. So I reach for the box of multigrain Cheerios, only to see that multigrain Cheerios are $3.99 a box, and that the generic Cheerios are $2.99. So I reach for the box of generic Cheerios. I'll spare you the entire interior monologue, but several minutes go by, and I spot my wife out of the corner of my eye looking at me like I've completely lost my mind because I can't pick a box of Cheerios. And so it was very much that failure of thinking too much, of trying to be too rational, coming up with too many reasons that first got me interested in the subject. I wanted to know what was happening inside my head as I struggled to make a serial selection, and more importantly, what should have been happening inside my head. And so that led me into this subject of decision-making and all this new research, which has just come out in the last couple of years.
Did you go with the original Cheerios?
Oh, gosh, that's a complicated question. What I do now, and I probably shouldn't give away my secret at the beginning of the interview, is I mix Honey Nut Cheerios and multigrain Cheerios in the same bowl. So that's my secret recipe for decision making.
Now, do you think our consumer culture, with this enormous abundance of choices, is making decision making more difficult for us, and it's making us crazy?
I do. I mean, this is often referred to as the paradox of choice, and there are some interesting studies that show, for example, there's actually an experiment done in a fancy grocery store in Menlo Park, and what they found was that when you give consumers three jam options to taste from, so they can sample strawberry jam, blueberry jam, and raspberry jam, about a third of the customers who try one of the jams will buy one of those jams. They'll find their favorite jam and pick one up. However, if you give them 25 different jam options to taste, to select from, so now you're getting all obscure. You're talking about apricot, blueberry jam, pomegranate, molasses jam, whatever. Now only 3% of consumers will stop and buy a jam. So I think it's a very clear case of how more choices, you know, if you were if you're a microeconomist, you'd assume that more choices would lead to more consumer satisfaction. And yet some part of our brain, there's some initial brain scanning evidence to confirm this, some part of our brain is actually gets scared by all these options that seem equivalent. You can actually see the amygdala, which is a brain area that's often associated with aversive feelings, turn on when people are confronted with options that at first glance seem identical, seem equivalent. And so it's that feeling of uncertainty, the uncertainty of not knowing which cereal to buy or not knowing which jam to buy. That's not a nice feeling.
I remember seeing a toddler at the playground once with her parents, and they were saying, Monica, do you want to go on the swing? Monica, do you want to go over here? Monica, do you? And they gave her 1,000 choices, yeah. And she just burst into tears.
Yeah. I mean, that's sounds like what I felt like whenever I have to buy toothpaste.
Now, you say in your book that decision-making isn't really what we think it is, that most of us tend to think that either we make rational decisions or we go with our gut. And you're saying that new science about the brain is showing us that it's more of like a conversation between those different parts of your brain, or perhaps between several different parts of your brain. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit about, just to get us oriented, what goes on in different parts of the brain and how, you know, we make decisions where.
Sure. So we can start with the very everyday example, a shopping decision, choosing to buy, you know, an iPod or a red cashmere sweater. So when you give people these shopping decisions in a brain scanner, what you see is that you show them the iPod or the cashmere sweater, and a brain area called the nucleus accumbens is turned on. This is a brain area that's often associated with pleasurable feelings, the feelings of reward. It's linked to the dopamine reward pathway. That's why you feel nice. You think about how good you look in the cashmere sweater or how much fun you'll have with your iPod. You feel happy. It makes you want that object. But then you show people the price tag that the iPod costs $199 and the cashmere sweater is expensive, and you see a brain area called the insula turn on. The insula is often associated with aversive feelings, things like bodily pain, disgust, loss, and it turns out paying for stuff. And so there's this emotional tug of war that goes on whenever you make a shopping decision. And when you put people in a brain scanner and you ask them whether or not they want to buy the new George Foreman grill, you can predict what they'll choose to buy before they actually make a decision, depending on, you know, these various levels of activation. So that kind of shows, I think, illustrates very neatly the kind of argument that takes place inside our head, this tug of war whenever we make a decision. And one, I think, interesting quirk about these shopping decisions is that when you pay with a credit card, the insula is less active than normal. Because credit cards abstract the transaction, because you're not literally taking cash out of your wallet, you're just swiping this plastic card and the charge will show up on your bill in 30 days, the insula doesn't quite understand what's going on, so it doesn't fully process the pain of paying. And that's why I think many scientists argue people spend so much money on the credit card. There's a great experiment I talk about in the book.
And that's why many finance counselors suggest that you cut up your credit cards.
Or put them in a block of ice in your freezer.
Yeah.
Do something. I mean, you know, I think there's lots of evidence that suggests that people buy stuff with their credit cards that they wouldn't normally buy. And there's an experiment done by MIT economists where they had people bid at an auction for Boston Celtics tickets. One group could bid with cash. One group had to bid with their credit cards. And what they found was that the group that bid with credit cards ended up bidding twice as much money for the same tickets as the group that bid with cash. And then it gets back to the insula. It just doesn't process the pain of paying when you pay with a credit card.
Now, throughout your book, you sort of give us a lot of different examples about when you use different parts of your brain and when that's useful. So one of the things that you talked about was really using your rational part of your brain and how that can save you in circumstances. And I'm wondering if you would tell this story about the firefighter who just, you know, instead of reacting to a fire coming his way with fear and heading for the hills, just sat down and thought about it for a second and saved his life.
Sure. This is a story of Wag Dodge and the Mann Gulch Fire. This was a fire in Montana in the early 50s. It was a very deadly prairie fire. And the smoke jumpers, there were 13 of them, they were parachuted into this fire. And when they left Missoula, Montana, they were told it was just a small fire, just a few burning acres. By the time they got there, though, the prairie fire had spread, and they were dropped off in the Mann Gulch, which is where the Rocky Mountains essentially meet the Great Plains. So it's a very uneven terrain. It's full of these very, very steep gulches, extremely steep grades. It's by the time the smoke jumpers arrive, gathered together their equipment, their shovels, their radios. Matt Wag Dodge, who's a smoke jumper in charge, realizes that the fire has gotten out of control, and so he orders his men to proceed down one side of this very steep gulch towards the Missouri River. He wants to be near water. He knows that near water is where it'll be safe in case the fire crowns, in case it gets even bigger. So the men start marching down this very, very steep gulch towards the river when, because it's 5 o'clock, this is when the twilight winds shift. And so the winds shift. And so the fire, these burning hot embers, all of a sudden change direction and now blow straight across the river, land on the side of the gulch that the men are on. So they're almost towards the river, but now the grass right between them and the river suddenly bursts into flames. Now, because heat moves uphill, fires accelerate going uphill. That's a dangerous thing about fighting prairie fires on a steep gulch. So the men, as soon as they see the fire cross the river, they drop all their stuff, and they start running up this very steep grade. Now, the fire's blown up. It's got this, you know, it's midsummer, so the tall, tall grass, it's 8 feet tall grass, is just burnt and dry. It explodes into flame. The flames are, according to some estimates, 200 feet tall. The fire is so hot it's melting the rock. It's 2,000 degrees. The flames start moving up this steep slope at 30 miles per hour. The men, meanwhile, are just trying to race up this hill as fast as they can. At this point, after about 30 seconds of running, that Wag Dodge realizes, he looks over his shoulder and realizes there's no way the men are going to outrun this fire, that it's only a matter of time before they're all burned alive. So Wag Dodge stops running. He yells at his men to stop running. Now, I think it's important to note that I think the most basic instinct we all have when we're being chased by fire is to run, right? I mean, it's you're being chased by a wall of flame. You want to run. That's your amygdala turning on and saying, get the hell out of here. This is, you're going to die. Run, run, run. Wag Dodge was able to realize that his fear was leading him nowhere, that this feeling of fear he had, this basic instinct, was actually going to kill him. So he ordered his men to stand still. None of his men stood still. They thought he was committing suicide. But Wag Dodge, in this most harrowing of moments, came up, had a moment of insight, came up with an escape plan. And this is what's now known as the escape fire. He got out the box of matches in his pocket, lit a match, lit the ground right in front of him, watched as the fire spread away, and then lay down in this burned patch of grass. Because fire can burn what's already been burnt, he just lay down there, wet his handkerchief with some water from his canteen, clutched it to his mouth, and waited for the fire to pass over him. That's how the escape fire, which is now a very common firefighting technique, was invented in this most harrowing of moments. And I think what that illustrates is, it's, you know, your emotional brain can be profoundly intelligent, can be profoundly wise, can often shock us with how much it knows, because it knows more than we know. And yet at the same time, it can also lead us in the wrong direction. So that's why it's so important to, when you're running from a fire, or in the case of Captain Sullenberger, when you're, you know, lost total engine power over New York City, why it's important to ask your emotional brain a question and to see if it's actually being helpful or if it's leading you, you know, to run up a hill when you can't outrun a fire.
Now, can you give us an example of kind of the opposite when you don't want to let your rational brain overthink, when you kind of want to check in more with your emotional brain, or just, I guess you don't really check in with your emotional brain, it just goes. But when is overthinking a bad idea?
Well, so in the case of Wag Dodge or Captain Sullenberger, what you see in the brain is the prefrontal cortex turns on. This is a uniquely human brain area. It's greatly enlarged during human evolution, and it allows us to kind of rebut our emotions, to think through fear and make sure our fear doesn't turn into panic. So, you know, everyone on the U.S. Airways flight is terrified. Everyone's scared. And yet, because Captain Sullenberger has this prefrontal cortex and because he's practiced thinking through fear, and pilots call this deliberate calm because staying calm requires deliberate effort, he was able to make a decision based on the facts, based on his altitude and airspeed, based on how far away Teterboro, New Jersey is, stuff like that. So the prefrontal cortex is what allows you to be rational, to make these considered deliberate decisions. Now, in terms of why sometimes the prefrontal cortex can backfire, this gets back to the sheer computational limitations of the prefrontal cortex. It's a magnificent piece of machinery. It's what allows Wag Dodge to invent the escape fire, and yet it can only handle about 7 pieces of information plus or minus 2 at any given moment. You give it more than that and you start to short-circuit it. So
that's why too many cereal.
decision.
Yes, exactly. Why when there were 20 different kinds of Cheerios, why I can't make up my mind. And yeah. So one of the experiments I talk about in the book was done by a Stanford psychology professor who he had two groups of students. And it's important to note at the outset that the prefrontal cortex doesn't just keep stuff in working memory or allow us to invent, you know, new ways to escape fire. It's also important for stuff like self-control, willpower, delayed gratification. So it's got to do a lot of stuff. You know, there's a heavy burden for this brain area. So back to the psychology experiment, he had two groups of students. One group had to remember a 2-digit random number. The other group had to remember a 7-digit random number. He told the students this was a test of long-term memory, but he was lying. He then marched the students down the hall where they had a choice of fruit salad, the responsible option, or a gooey, rich slice of chocolate cake. What he found was that the students given 7 digits to remember were almost twice as likely to choose chocolate cake as the students given 2 digits. And that's simply because all it took was 5 extra numbers to, in a sense, short-circuit the prefrontal cortex, to overwhelm it. So there wasn't enough processing power left over to actually resist the slice of chocolate cake. And I think that illustrates just how bounded this bit of brain is. And why sometimes, in some circumstances, it can actually lead us astray. So I'll give you another example of when it can be wise to, I think, trust your emotional brain. This is an experiment done by a neuroscientist named Antonio Damasio. It's known as the Iowa gambling task. And the experiment goes like this. There are 4 decks of cards. Each deck, 2 decks are much better than the others. But each deck, you pick up a card, and it'll say you won $75, or you lost $200, or, you know, you won $10, and so on. And so the job of these subjects in the experiment is to pick up decks from these cards until they figure out which decks are the best. And so when you give people these 4 decks of cards, what you find is that it takes about 50 to 60 cards before people can explain why one deck is better than the other. You have to draw a lot of cards. Logic is slow. It takes a while to accumulate enough evidence in order to realize that one deck is the best and the other 3 decks aren't so good. However, when you hook up people's hands to a machine that measures the electrical skin conductance, so that measures anxiety, stress, nervousness, what you find is that their hands start to get nervous, their hands start to get sweaty whenever they reach for the bad decks of cards after only 6 or 7 cards. So in a sense, their hand, their emotional brain, knows much more than they know. It's responding to facts. It's taking in information much quicker than their rational brain is. So that's just a small example. In the book, I talk about that in terms of professional poker players and how poker players have learned, you know, they have to really practice listening and learning and eavesdropping on their emotional brain, but how really what they're picking up on is those very subtle signals, those sweaty palms that allow them to act on information they may have no conscious awareness of.
So some of that is pattern recognition when you've been doing something like playing poker or flying a plane or whatever. You can pick up, you can sense differences in the situation on an emotional level that you can't rationally.
Absolutely. I think that's what the emotional brain is so good at, is detecting these patterns in reality that because of the processing power limitations of the rational brain kind of elude the prefrontal cortex. And yet, you know, the unconscious knows much more than we know. It's taking in far more information than we're aware of. I mean, another great experiment that demonstrates this was done by psychologists in Germany. They had people watch a soap opera, and at the bottom of the soap opera was a ticker tape, like you see on CNBC, you know, stocks going up or down, fluctuating in value. There were 20 different stocks on this ticker tape. And so you have people watch the soap opera and watch the ticker tape for half an hour, and then you ask them, you know, which stocks went up, which stocks did the best. And they'll say, I have no idea. That was way too much information. I can't begin to tell you which stocks did best. However, when you ask them, okay, which stocks feel the best? Just tell us which stocks are associated with the most positive emotions. What you find is that now, all of a sudden, their emotional brain is actually really accurate at telling you which stocks did well. That's because even though you have no conscious awareness of the ticker tape, you know, that was way too much information from your prefrontal cortex to handle, your emotional brain took in this information and processed it and then generates emotions, these very subtle feelings that kind of guide your actions and tell you what to do. So I think it's these kind of instances, and this is pretty counterintuitive. I think most of us might trust our, you know, gut instincts to pick a dish for dinner
order something off a menu, but we never trusted to pick a stock or to make a complex decision. And, you know, what the science suggests, and there's some initial evidence to support this, is that it's the really hard decisions in life, the decisions that involve lots and lots of information, lots of variables, that most benefit from a more emotional thought process.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the opera singer who got kind of messed up by overthinking and that kind of short-circuiting of your skills by thinking too much.
Well, this is known as choking. We're all familiar with it. We've all seen Shaq try to make free throws or watch golfers implode on the 18th hole. And what choking seems to be, and this a lot of this work is done by a professor of psychology named Sean Baylock at Northwestern University, is simply we're thinking too much. We become too self-conscious. So what she actually does is she brings in novice golfers and professional golfers into her lab, and she... First, what she shows is that novice golfers do better when they think about their strokes and when they contemplate the details of a golf swing. So they think about keeping their wrist taut and keeping their elbows tucked in and their hips straight and all the stuff that golfers have to think about when they're learning how to swing a golf club. That thinking about a golf stroke when you're a beginner makes you hit better, makes you hit the ball better because you avoid beginner's mistakes. However, when she brings in professional golfers into her lab and tells them to pay attention to their torqued wrist or, you know, keeping their elbows in, all of a sudden now they choke. They become so focused on keeping their elbows in that they lose the natural fluidity of motion that they've trained for, that they've practiced all these years. So they've taken the skill on autopilot that's performed best on autopilot and transferred it over to their deliberative brain, and that's where things start to backfire. And that's so where opera singers choke and mm-hmm. baseball pitchers start missing the strike zone and golfers, their swing breaks down. So become
so
self-conscious.
So when Renee Fleming thinks about, is she going to hit the high A, that's when she misses it.
Exactly. And so it's important to know that there are moments of everyday life, like driving, like if you're a professional golfer, like hitting a golf ball, or if you're an opera singer, like singing an opera, that are best performed on autopilot, that are best performed by the, you know, trained neurons in the emotional brain.
And it sounded like picking art was one of those things. You mentioned a study where people had a choice of a poster of a Van Gogh or a Monet or kitties.
Yes.
And when they started to think about it, they picked the kitties. And when they didn't think about it, they picked the art.
Yeah, and you survey them after the fact, and it turns out that people prefer the art. This is work done by Timothy Wilson at the University of Virginia, and he also did a study on strawberry jam, where he, Consumer Reports in the mid-80s, did an exhaustive survey of strawberry jams, where they ranked the top 55 strawberry jams in the country. So Acme was near the top, Knott's Berry Farm was up there, Smucker's was up there, et cetera, et cetera. He was curious if undergraduate students would share the same preferences as these tasting experts at Consumer Reports. What he found was that if you just gave these jams to undergraduate students, that they were pretty good at finding the best jams, at least according to Consumer Reports, and that there was this very strong correlation between the jams preferred by students and the jams preferred by Consumer Reports. However, all of a sudden, when you ask people to explain why they like one jam as opposed to another jam, now the correlation all but disappeared. Some of the worst-tasting jams, according to Consumer Reports, were ranked highest by these students who had to explain their decisions. And the reason is simple, that when you give someone a jam and they taste the jam, but they have to come up with a reason for it, they go, this jam has a chunky texture. And they think, you know, chunky texture, I don't like chunky textures. That's a good reason to not like a jam. When the reality is, they may very well not even care about texture, or they may even like chunky texture. But when you start searching for reasons, you know, rational reasons to prefer one jam over another, you end up overriding these subtle preferences that your brain is actually trying to tell you.
Another way that you talked about the way that our rational minds trick us was with the placebo effect, and also with, when we have an expectation of something, like when you tell someone a wine is really expensive, then you're going to say, I love that wine. And when you tell them that the same wine is really cheap, they're like, oh, it just, you know, it's a little too fruit forward for me. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. I mean, the placebo effect is very powerful. I mean, it's easy to make fun of it, but we often forget that all medicine was, until 100 years ago, was the placebo effect. That's all we had to heal us. And it's still very tough for many conditions to design a drug that works better than the placebo effect in controlled tests. So the placebo effect is very powerful. And what you see when you put people in a brain scanner, put them in an fMRI machine, and you give them a hand moisturizer, and Betalum is a very powerful new painkiller, and then give them electrical shock, but tell them that, you know, right afterwards you're going to put this powerful painkiller on that's actually hand moisturizer. What you see is parts of their brain, the prefrontal cortex, the quote-unquote rational brain, lights up because they expect to feel less pain, and so their insula, this brain area that actually responds to things like bodily pain, is less active, simply because they expect to feel less pain. So you can actually watch the placebo effect in action. This is studies done by scientists at Columbia University. And the same phenomena is at work all the time in everyday life. So I talk about another set of experiments done where people actually had, this is done by scientists at Caltech, where they actually had people sip wine via long plastic tubes in a brain scanner, and they had people sample 3 different wines, but told them they're actually 5 different wines. So they told them, so then sample a $5 wine, a $15 bottle of wine, and a $90 bottle of wine. Sure enough, when you tell people they're sampling a $90 bottle of wine, they say, oh, this is my favorite. This is the most elegant, refined wine. Such delicious fruit. Oh, I can taste the raspberries. On and on and on. And you see parts of the brain that respond to pleasure light up much more when they're tasting a $90 bottle of wine, even if that $90 bottle of wine is actually $15. So even if you give them a cheap wine and tell them it's expensive, you still see the same pattern of pleasurable activation in the brain. The interesting kind of, I think, the end note to the story is that when they gave the wines to the volunteers, even trained wine-tasting volunteers, so people who know what they're talking about in theory, they gave them all these wines but completely blind. The favorite wine of just about everybody was the $5 bottle of wine. So when you deprive the brain of its placebo expectations, of the fact that we expect the most expensive wines to taste the best, it turns out we actually like the cheap plonk most of all. And this isn't just, they did this with the Stanford Wine Club, and I don't want to just pick on the Stanford Wine Club. There are a whole set of other experiments done by research at the University of Bordeaux where they had trained French wine critics, and they served them a very cheap $2 bottle of, wine, the hearty Burgundy in those big plastic jugs. And they serve this bottle of wine in a cheap bottle of wine, but also in a very expensive first-class Bordeaux bottle of wine. So the exact same wine in 2 different bottles. And they asked the wine critics, professional wine critics, to describe these 2 wines. Needless to say, when the cheap wine was in the expensive bottle, it was elegant, austere, refined. When it was in the cheap bottle, it was cheap, fruitless, rancid, all the rest. So, this is very easy to pick on wine critics. This is something that happens to all of us all the time. What we perceive is very much a product of what we think we're going to perceive. So to paraphrase Paul Simon, a man tastes what he wants to taste or sees what he wants to see and disregards the rest.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I've never quite understood is why computers, until I guess the game with Kasparov, couldn't beat grandmaster chess players. I mean, computers have all of. I mean, chess is a game of rationality, no? Yeah. And you have all of this power behind these big blue computers, and still a human being was able to beat a computer at chess. How did that happen?
Well, Garry Kasparov can now. I mean, he's probably when he fought Deep Blue, the IBM supercomputer, to a draw. It was generally hailed as, triumph of the machine. Computers are smarter than people. He was the best chess player in the world, and he can't even beat a bundle of silicon microchips. If you talk to a scientist, though, I think most scientists are kind of shocked, as you put it, that the computer didn't just blow Garry Kasparov out of the water. And I think, what that comparison really misses is just how efficient Garry Kasparov's mind is. I mean, think about it this way. That's Deep Blue can roughly compute 10 million more moves per second than Garry Kasparov's very limited rational brain. So it's a much more powerful machine from the sheer computational perspective. Even more important, it consumes tons of energy. I mean, Deep Blue is a fire hazard. It requires specialized heat-dissipating equipment. It consumes thousands of dollars worth of energy every hour. Garry Kasparov's brain, meanwhile, room temperature, 98.6 degrees, consumes as much electricity as a 20-watt light bulb. And yet he can fight this machine to a draw. And I think that gets back to just why the human brain is so amazing, why it's so efficient. And I talk in the book about this gets back to how the brain learns, how it sees in terms of patterns and predictions and dopamine neurons and the prediction error signal and all these ways that allow the brain to really very efficiently see patterns in the real world and to learn from those patterns. And that's something that supercomputers, at least until very recently, haven't been able to fully make use of. I think it's only the last couple of years that you've started to see computer programs, like, for example, the best backgammon player in the world right now is actually a computer that can run on a very ordinary laptop. And that's because this backgammon program uses a very similar algorithm to that used by your dopamine neurons. It's called temporal difference learning or prediction error learning, in the sense that it makes predictions and then compares these predictions to what actually happens. It sounds very straightforward, and it is, but it's a very efficient way to learn. And that's how your cells learn. That's how they evolved to learn over millions and millions and millions of years. I think for the first time we're starting to apply that to things like backgammon programs, but it's also being used to program banks of elevators, cell phone towers. It turns out to be a very efficient way to learn.
One of the things that you give many examples of in your book is how our decision-making processes get in our way. And one of the examples that you gave was about how people are willing to commute long distances just to live in a bigger house. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about that calculus. Sure. And how it is that, you know, people are kind of willing to make themselves miserable for 2 hours a day in order to have a guest room.
This is kind of related to the work we talked about earlier in terms of strawberry jam and how we come up with all these reasons. The brain is so great at generating reasons. And even when these reasons don't apply, even when they're irrelevant, they sound good to us. And so we end up following them. So this is preliminary work done by researchers at the University of the Netherlands. What they did was they asked people to compare, you know, options we're all pretty familiar with, so that you can have a big house in the suburbs, 4-bedroom house, 3.5 bathrooms. The problem is there's a 1-hour commute each way. Or plan B is a condo in the city. It's only 2 bedrooms, 1.5 baths, but it's a 5-minute walk to the office. So when you ask people what they'll choose, and if you just have them choose right away, it's about split 50-50. They tend to choose the condo just more than half the time, right? Because they think about, oh, commuting's terrible. That would stink to have to commute, you know, an hour each day. So they choose the condo. However, the more time you give them to contemplate these options, the more important that extra bedroom becomes. They start thinking about, oh, you know, Grandpa Joe can visit on Christmas. He could stay in the bed on Christmas. That extra bathroom would be so helpful when my sister visits. Oh, and when the kids come home from college, they could really use that extra bedroom too. So we come up with all these reasons why that extra bedroom's essential, even when we're really only going to use it, you know, 3 times a year. And so the end result, and what we fail to really think about, is just how awful commuting is. You know, when you give people beepers and then beep them at random intervals and ask them to rate how happy they are, what you find is that they're least happy when commuting. That commuting is about as bad as it gets in terms of daily activities. This is for a variety of reasons, because it's unpredictable, so you can never fully adapt to the, you know, pain of commuting. And so people come up with all these reasons why that extra bedroom is so important and stop thinking about what actually is important, which is that commuting sucks and that it makes you very unhappy to commute an hour.
Some of you who came a long way to be here tonight,
yeah,
I'm sure lead really happy lives.
Yes.
But go ahead.
But so that's a classic example, and I think it's an example many Americans, it's a mistake many Americans, yeah, are making. You know, these long, extreme commuters are the fastest growing segment of commuters, people who have to commute 2 hours each way or more. So this really is, in a sense, a byproduct of thinking too much, of obsessing over the wrong things, obsessing over the extra bedroom when we should really be obsessing over sitting on the 101 freeway for an hour every morning.
Well, this kind of brings me to a question of, you know, you give many examples of how you should use your rational brain here, you should rely more on your emotional brain there. Well, how are we supposed to know when I'm making any given decision? Should I go with my gut? Should I go with my brain, especially if they're conflicting? Do you have any guidelines for us about how to decide whether or not to commute or buy the house or whether or not to buy that cashmere sweater?
I've got some rough guidelines in the book. It's important to note this is very preliminary science, and so, you know, you can extract as best you can a self-help manual based on the fMRI research and cell recordings and stuff like that. But I think the most important lesson to take away and the most important moral we can all learn from this research is something called metacognition, trying to cultivate metacognition. I love metacognition because it sounds like a very complex word. It sounds intimidating, but it's really the simplest thing. It's thinking about thinking. Probably the classic example of metacognition is a tip of the tongue moment, you know, when you meet someone on the street and you know their name. It's in your head somewhere, but you can't quite summon it to the surface. And that's always struck me as very profound, you know, how you know what you don't know, how you know you have a memory of a name if you can't produce it. And that's because we're naturally metacognitive. We naturally think about thinking. And when it comes to decision making, this can be a really important skill in the sense that it allows you to properly adjust your thought process to the task at hand. So given what scientists have discovered in terms of when the emotional brain is useful or when we should really flex our prefrontal cortex and try to think things through, whether, you know, we're a pilot in a cockpit and we just lost engine power, or we're trying to act on all sorts of information that's out of our control, whether or not we're trying to choose which house to buy or which strawberry jam to buy. So given that science knows that certain situations benefit from certain types of thinking, metacognition allows you to really adjust your thought process to the task at hand. And that, I think, is how learning about how the brain works and how the brain makes decisions can actually make you a better decider.
It seems to me that meditation is basically the process of metacognition. And I know that there have some neuroscientists have looked at the brains of, you know, Buddhist monks, people who've meditated for a long time. And I'm wondering if you know anything about how meditation can affect our decision-making processes.
Yeah, I think meditation is a perfect example of metacognition. It's an extreme form, but I think there's some really suggestive evidence that a lot of it based on Buddhist monks, that metacognition can really transform the structure of your brain and how you think. And one of my favorite examples comes from the work of a guy named Mark Beam at Northwestern University and John Kunios at Drexel, and they study moments of insight, what happens in your brain when you have an epiphany. And what they found is that these epiphanies, these moments of insight, tend to come from relatively obscure circuit of cells in the right hemisphere, and that it's easiest to access these circuit of cells, to listen to what they have to say when we're relaxed, when we're not too focused on a particular problem. You know, that's why when you're stuck on a problem and you just really try to focus on it, you just come up with the same wrong solution over and over and over again. What you should be doing is taking a warm shower, or going for a long walk, finding some way to relax yourself, to distract yourself enough so that you can kind of tap into these remote associations. So back to Buddhist monks and metacognition. So they tell this great story about how one day they were measuring a Buddhist monk. They have this really cute experimental protocol where they give people word problems and have them generate insights. And so they gave this Buddhist monk these word problems, and at first he couldn't solve a single one. And this confused them because, you know, he was a smart guy, and normally these word problems are solved about 40% of the time, and yet he couldn't solve a single one. What was going wrong? But then after about 35 failed word problems, failed moments of insight, he started solving one insight problem after another. He became, as John Kunios put it to me, an insight machine. And what they believed was happening was that because he was a practiced meditator, he developed these incredible metacognitive skills. And at first, he was simply too focused on the word problems. He was so locked in that he couldn't listen to this obscure circuit of cells in his right hemisphere. And so he couldn't solve a single one. But then after about 35, he got the hang of it. He realized that what he had to do was focused on not being focused. And that's when he became an insight machine. That's when he solved one problem after another. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an extreme example, but something we can all hope to cultivate, which is this ability to learn how to direct our thoughts. And in the case of that Buddhist monk, you can see that it had this tremendous payoff.
Yeah. I noticed in your book that the studies seem to be gender neutral, or at least gender wasn't mentioned, and you didn't mention gender in the book. And of course, stereotypically, we all think of women as being more intuitive and men as being more rational. And I'm wondering in your research what you've found about the truth of that, if there really are big differences between men and women, or is that the topic of your next book?
it's not the topic of my next book, I think it's safe to say. I think when you talk to most decision-making scientists, they're pretty scornful of that cliche. They're pretty scornful of that generalization. I think one reason we tend to imagine women being more intuitive and more emotional gets back to the fact that for most of Western history, we scorned the emotions. We thought the emotions were things you should ignore and repress. They were the bad side of cognition. And so I think because we saw the female mind, for all sorts of terrible, erroneous, sexist reasons, as being somehow inferior to the male mind, one way we tarnished the female mind was to say, oh, it's more emotional, it's more intuitive, it's more precious and fragile. So I think in general, what you see is that a lot of the crucial brain areas for decision making are bilateral. They're gender neutral in that sense. One, I think, interesting thing that I think some studies have found, and this is a lot largely based on the work of a guy named Colin Kammerer at Caltech, is when you have people play a trust game. It's a simple economic game where you have to trust someone else with your money, and then they invest it, and if they decide to give you your money back and they don't violate your trust, then you get more money in return. So it's a simple economic exchange game. It's been played by economists for a long time. When you put people in a brain scanner, what you find is there's a slight gender difference, that men will play the game, they'll hand over the money, and then as soon as they get money in return or don't get money in return, their trust has been violated, their brain shuts off. They basically stop thinking about the exchange. So the brain areas that light up when they're contemplating the trust game, the economic exchange, turn off within a few seconds of the exchange being completed.
Now, is that conditioned or is that hardwired?
That seems to be pretty universal. Most men will play the game that way, where, you know, they think about the exchange while it's happening, and then once it's over, they're done with it. They're ready to move on to the next exchange. Women, however, play the game a bit differently. They play the economic exchange game, and they'll hand over their money or not hand over the money, and then depending on what happens, they'll keep on mulling it over. So their brain, you can see their brain keep on contemplating this interaction. And I think, you know, the reason I like one, you know, this is the gender difference that I tend to not kind of disparage or brush aside, is because it does jive a bit better with my own personal experience. You know, my wife and I will go to a dinner party, and we come home, and I'm ready to read something or fall asleep or watch SportsCenter or whatever, and she's interested in talking about the dinner party some more. She's interested in kind of pursuing the social interaction a bit more. And I think it's an experience that many people are familiar with. It's a gross generalization, to be sure, so you don't want to push it too hard, but I think it's, you know, it's a generalization that may is the important word here, have some basis in the brain, that women are more sensitive to social interactions. The reason they're more sensitive is because they think about them more, and that once the exchange or interaction is done, they keep on thinking about it.
We're going to take questions from the audience in just a couple of minutes. So if you'd like to ask a question, now would be the time to stand up and get ready to ask your question. Now, isn't it true, I've read stories that on the very high end of rationality, like in super high end math, men are better than women?
That question's a bit beyond my purview, but I mean, These things are all very tough. I think it's very tough. There's so many variables at work here in terms of
nature, nurture.
Mm-hmm. It's tough to imagine there being a set of math genes that are somehow relegated to the Y chromosome. So I think it's important to kind of reject the extreme at both ends. And there may be a slight preference. It may be easier for men to learn math. But, you know, again, I think the evidence at this point is very, very inconclusive.
Now, I just want to ask you a quick question about your previous book. Proust was a neuroscientist, which is about writers and painters and composers who discovered some truths about the human mind that you say that science is only now discovering. And you gave examples of Proust, Cézanne, a lot of the modernists, Virginia Woolf. And I'm just wondering if you can give us a little taste of that book and tell us what you mean by these artists anticipating neuroscience.
Sure. I got the idea for the book. I was working in a lab, and we were studying the chemistry of memory, what happens in your brain when you make a memory. And I had to read Proust for school, and so I was reading Swan's Way, and it's a novel that's really about one man's memory. It's an investigation into Marcel's own childhood memories. And probably the most famous scene in Swan's Way is when Proust, Marcel the narrator, dips a madeleine, a lemon seashell-shaped cookie, into his tea. And then all of a sudden he puts the cookie, the butter crumbs in his mouth, and he's got this seized with this intense childhood memory that he thought he'd forgotten. But he says very explicitly that it's by taste and smell alone that the memory came flooding back to him, that he'd seen Madeleines and bakeries all across Paris and never remembered anything. It wasn't until he put the cookie in his mouth and inhaled the sweet crumbs with the lime flower tea that the memories returned. And that actually, unbeknownst to Proust at the time, that actually captures a very interesting bit of cerebral anatomy, that the olfactory cortex, the part of brain that actually responds to smell and taste, that's actually uniquely connected to the hippocampus. It's got a direct connection to the hippocampus, which is the center of long-term memory. All your other senses have to go somewhere else first and then go to the hippocampus. So in a sense, Proust was right, that our sense of smell and taste is uniquely nostalgic. And he intuited this simply by being a very sensitive observer of how his own mind worked. And that's just a small example of what Proust and others discovered. But I think it gets back to, I think, the larger idea of artists aren't just trying to spin us, you know, entertaining tales, fantasies and fictions. What they're also trying to do often is trying to describe human experience, trying to, as W.H. Auden put it, keep reality on the agenda. And I think it's that act of trying to describe experience, to articulate this thing we all take for granted, you know, this here now, subjective experience. They can actually learn really important, tangible truths about how the mind works.
I'm wondering if there are any questions from the audience now, or if I should. And there are microphones on either side. And if you'd like to ask a question, actually just on this side, if you'd like to ask a question, I'd like to ask you to go up to the microphone and line up at the microphone in order to ask your question. So if you'd like to do that, go ahead.
I was wondering if through conscious effort, through rational thought, we could change the response patterns of the insula or the nucleus accumbens, or maybe change their relative threshold levels?
Sure. It's an excellent question. I think there's some preliminary evidence that I think to the surprise of many, you actually can. And this is another study done with Buddhist monks. And what you find is that for a long time, people had thought that the amygdala was one of these primal brain structures we just simply couldn't control. It was too primal, too reptilian, too deep in the limbic system that all the training in the world couldn't alter its activity. But you actually find with Buddhist monks that when you play them a startle response, so something like a backfiring car, that you actually see a reduced amygdala response, that they have this kind of baseline level of calm that is very tough to penetrate. So that's some suggestive evidence that really rigorous, strict training can actually change how the amygdala responds to scary stimuli. I think in general, though, most of us obviously aren't trained expert Buddhist monks. What you see is that the amygdala is pretty much a reflex, that it generates a response that's pretty much out of conscious control. The crucial variable, though, and the crucial variable that predicts people's behavior in, for example, fMRI experiments, is how active their prefrontal cortex is, how much it turns on to compensate for this amygdala activity, for the activity of these emotional brain areas. And so, for example, in the case of Captain Sullenberger, you know, I think it's a fair assumption, and as he's freely admitted, he was very scared in that cockpit. You know, he was terrified. Everyone was scared. Imagine how scary that is to lose total engine power over the densest city in America. And yet what he was able to do, and the thing pilots practice for in flight simulators, is turning on the prefrontal cortex to kind of compensate. This is called deliberate calm because it takes deliberate effort to stay calm under such harrowing circumstances. So I think, you know, there's some evidence on the one hand that if you really try, you can change your amygdala. You can kind of begin to modulate its response to anxiety. But I think the more important variable, the variable that's more relevant for the rest of us, is learning how to activate your prefrontal cortex. And the important thing to know about the prefrontal cortex is that it's a brain area we can all easily control. It's the brain area we can most easily control. It's kind of the warehouse of conscious thoughts. So trying to direct your attention, trying to control what you're thinking about, the contents of working memory can have a big payoff.
I just wanted to remind our audience that this is the Commonwealth Club's InForum program, and tonight we're here with Jonah Lehrer, who is the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and most recently, How We Decide. Let's take another question.
Yes, I was wondering if you can expand on the question of how do you decide which way to go in your decision-making, whether it's intuitive or basically computational. I have a second question, but
we're just going to let you have one.
You're just going to let me have one?
Sure. I think probably the easiest way to, the easiest way many scientists would kind of give us advice on how to structure our decision-making in everyday life is, and this is very counterintuitive, as I said before, but it's the very complex decisions. It's the ones that involve lots of information, lots of variables. So if there are lots of jams on display, lots of cereals on display, if you're trying to choose between a car, for example, cars have lots and lots of variables, then those are decisions that seem to benefit most from an emotional thought process. It's relatively simple decisions or novel decisions. So decisions in which we have no experience or decisions that don't involve lots of information that seem to most benefit from a more rational, deliberative thought process. That's because the emotional brain can be very, very wise, but it's also subject to a long list of hardwired flaws.
So what you're saying, can I just interrupt? I know in your book you said that the average person spends 35 hours deciding what car to buy. And so what you're saying
they've
is...
They've got it backwards.
Really?
They should spend 35 seconds.
You should say, I'm so happy because that's what I did. I was like, I'm going to buy that car, and I did it. It took me 5 minutes.
Maybe not 35 seconds. 5 minutes might be the right amount of time. There's actually an experiment that speaks directly to car buying. And this was done by, again, these researchers at the University of the Netherlands. And they had two groups. One group they gave an easy car buying decision to. So they gave them four cars. Each of these cars was rated in four different categories. So horsepower, fuel economy, trunk space, leg room, stuff like that. So 16 total pieces of information. What you find when you give people these easy car buying scenarios is that they make the best car decision. They find the optimal car. One of these four cars is rationally the best car. It's got the most horsepower, the most trunk space, best fuel economy, etc. That they find the best car when they think it through. When they take a few minutes to consider their options and try to rationally locate the best option, the best car alternative. However, in the hard car buying scenario, and it's worth pointing out that the hard car buying scenario is much more realistic, this was a scenario in which they had the same four cars, but now each car was rated in 12 different categories. So for a total of 48 pieces of information, far more information than simply, you know, the original scenario. Now what you find is that the people who are forced to rationally think it through, who try to contemplate consciously all their car options, now they perform worse in random chance. They select the best car less 25% of the time. The best way to find the best car in the hard scenario is to, and this is kind of surprising, to let people assimilate the information, kind of stare at the facts, stare at all these different cars and all their different categories, then give them a word puzzle to distract them for 5 minutes. And then while they're solving this word puzzle, interrupt them very quickly and say, quick, pick the best car. And now what you find is that they find the best car more than half the time. That because they're forced to rely on this more emotional thought process, that they're able to really, I think, assess their complex options and kind of sift through all this information and find the best alternative.
That's great. I'd like to get some other people an opportunity to ask a question. Go ahead.
Hi. I work with professional soccer teams worldwide, and I notice, you know, a big difference between, for example, the emotional state of a head coach from Scandinavia compared to a head coach from South America versus another head coach or a player from Asia. The question that I have is there any research that potentially is trying to determine specific neurophysiological identities based on race? For example, does a guy that comes from Latin America, does he have a more active amygdala compared to a prefrontal cortex or vice versa, or a German, you know, activates that part of the brain less, you know, so.
It's a great question. I wish I had a good answer for you. There really is very little evidence in terms of the neurophysiology at the moment to speak of. My one caution, I think we can all kind of relate to the generalization, you know, I just know from listening to the announcers, you know, announce soccer matches, that we listen to the announcers in Spanish, it's much more emotive. They're much more into the match. I think the crucial distinction here, though, and this is why you may not see the same, and that's why you may not see the same dramatic difference at the level of the brain, is that there's a crucial distinction between the expression of emotions, how much we express our feelings, and what's actually happening on your inside. So in the case of Captain Sullenberger, again, he described, you know, turmoil on the inside, calm on the outside. Even though his amygdala was active, he appeared calm. So I think, you know, I wish I had a good answer for you. It's a great, great question, but you know, the research hasn't been done, and I'm not sure, even if the research was done, you might not see the same dramatic difference that seems very apparent to you as a, you know, well-experienced observer of these differences, that there tends to be a distinction between what we see on people's faces and in their emotive bodily expressions and what's actually happening at the level of distinct brain structures.
So the guy could be very scared, but he just doesn't show to be...
Yeah, you could be very scared or very happy, but because of these cultural differences, you may not show it in the same way. So often the expression of emotions is very culturally conditioned, especially in terms of how flamboyant those expressions are. And that often doesn't necessarily correlate with what's actually happening inside your brain.
Fascinating. Never thought about that. Thank you very much.
Next question. You actually had a lot of sports talk in your book, which I didn't ask you about, but... There's a lot of sports examples in here.
Hi. We know that people with severe seizures, epilepsy, or grand mal, when they have their corpus callosum severed, they can't take decisions whether which shirt to take. It takes them at least 35 minutes to pick up the shirt they want to put up that day. How did they decide?
That's another great question. A lot of this work is done by Michael Gazzaniga, and they've shown, for example, that when you split people's hemispheres in two, when you sever the corpus callosum, the thick nerve that connects your two hemispheres, people can often act in very funny ways. And this is simply because your hemispheres often have two very different preferences. So there are funny, poignant examples of, for example, people will read a book with their left hand and the right hand's trying to close it, or vice versa, because only one of your hemispheres is proficient at reading. So it doesn't understand why you want to look at these funny symbols on a page. And so it's trying to close your hand. I think the most poignant example is the case of a married couple. The husband had his corpus callosum cut, and one half of his body was much nicer to his wife than the other half of his body. So you often see this incredible contradiction in your hemispheres, and that's simply because it gets back to the larger, I think, the fact that your brain isn't this neat, coherent blob, but actually is this distinct network of different brain areas, often which have different desires, which want different things, which look at the world through different prisms and filters. And so when you subdivide the brain and you prevent this crosstalk from happening, I think you can easily expose these inherent contradictions. And you know, as absurd as those examples seem, we talked about with, you know, everyday shopping decisions, you can see a similar contradiction inside the brain. One brain area wants you to buy the iPod, the other brain area says, don't spend money. So there's often this, you know, this similar argument taking place, and when you sever a brain area, when you sever this crosstalk, you simply make the argument transparent. So it's the same phenomena is happening in all our brains all the time. We just simply aren't aware of it.
Thank you. Next question.
Hi. When you were talking about the golf players and the opera singers, you seem to be making a distinction between a kind of a fluid, unconscious automaticity versus a conscious control and awareness. And I was wondering, conversational speech seems to me in many ways to be very fluid in a very similar way. If I talk and if I'm in a very quick, flowing, fluid conversation, I'm not necessarily thinking beforehand about what I'm going to say. Yet, in many ways, we would want to think about that as being kind of the epitome or the archetypical conscious control example. So how does that complicate that distinction? And what do you think that means in terms of the neurobiology?
That's another great question. I think that really elegantly captures, I think, the fluid interface between conscious deliberative processes and unconscious processes we take for granted. And I think driving is a similar way, in the sense that you know where you're driving, and yet you can space out for minutes at a time, daydream about something else, and your foot will still step on the brake and shift gears and do all the rest. And I think sentence construction is a similar thing, in that there's lots of evidence from Noam Chomsky onwards that the act of constructing a sentence, putting your verb here, your noun here, slotting in, you know, adjectives where necessary, that all takes place out of sight, out of awareness. It's very unconscious, and thank goodness, otherwise we'd, you know, we can never say anything because we'd be so worried about actually properly constructing sentences, diagramming sentences in her head. So that process is largely automatic, it's reflexive, and yet at the same time, it's got a very fluid interaction with what we actually want to say, with these conscious thoughts, with the ideas that are neatly and automatically slotted into these very well-diagrammed sentences that just flow out of our mouth. So I mean, I would use speech as a perfect example of what the human brain does so magnificently that we take it for granted, which is this seamless interaction between reflexes, automatic reactions, stuff that takes place in very primitive brain areas, from the brainstem to the emotional brain and upwards. And at the same time, these robotic reflexes are based on in this constant dialogue with very deliberative conscious thoughts.
Next question.
Hi, thanks so much for coming. So my question is related to where you started with the choice of the Cheerios. And I'm wondering, I'm the kind of person where when faced with that kind of choice, I run away and don't ever pick a box of cereal. So I'm wondering about indecision. And in a lot of these studies, it seems as if, not that they're forced to choose between one or the other, but people who are in the fMRI scans, they have to decide. They're not left with any room to run away. And if you know anything about that and sort of what happens when we run away and why we do it.
Yeah, I think it's a really rich scientific subject. I think it really speaks to the question of uncertainty. I think we can all see now with the economy just how powerful a role uncertainty can play. The fact that we don't know what's going to happen to the economy next quarter or whether or not Citibank or Bank of America will be in business in a month. That kind of uncertainty can often lead to, you know, catastrophic consequences in the economy at large. And yet uncertainty, I think, is a vastly understudied scientific subject. Why not knowing for sure is so problematic for us, makes us so scared, makes us so unwilling to choose and act. So people won't invest in the stock market simply because they don't know what's going to happen. And we don't want to pick a cereal because we don't know which cereal is the best. I think in terms of everyday consumer behavior, some of the best advice comes from a great psychologist named Herbert Simon, who he famously distinguished between maximizers and satisficers. Maximizers were the people who always needed to get the best cereal. They weren't satisfied unless they got the best box of Cheerios, the box of Cheerios that would make them the happiest. They needed to maximize their utility. And what you find is maximizers, even though they're trying to make themselves very happy, end up being the least happy. They're full of regret. They're always thinking, oh, I should have gotten the apple cinnamon Cheerios. What am I doing with the multigrain or whatever? And you compare that to satisficers. And satisficers are happy being satisfied. They realize that maybe one day they want honey nut, maybe one day they want apple cinnamon, maybe one day they want multigrain. You know, that people are funny animals. And so they're happy being satisfied. And when you survey people, you find that satisficers, even though they're not trying to always be happy, end up much happier, much less regretful, much less doubtful. They don't just think about all the things they should have gotten if only they'd done things differently. So I think in terms of everyday consumer behavior, the best way to get over these kinds of hang-ups, which trust me, I understand where you're coming from, can be a very debilitating thing.
We've got 2 minutes. Can we get one last quick question?
Sure. So try to be a satisficer.
Hi, I was watching Stephen Colbert about a week or so ago when you were on, and that's what prompted me to commute this long distance to come here. But you were talking about something with somebody who didn't have the ability to emotionally connect in a decision.
Yeah,
and they actually had a physiological problem that do it. And you were starting to explain it, and then he interrupted you as he is wont to do. And I was really, I wonder if you could expand on that a bit.
In a minute.
Sure. This is work I talk about in the book. It's done by a neurologist named Antonio Damasio. And in the early 80s, and this really helped overturn the rational agent model, the assumption that goes back to Plato that rationality is always great. And he looked at patients who, because of a brain tumor, had lost the ability to experience any emotion at all. So they couldn't feel the everyday feelings of fear or pleasure or whatever that we all take for granted. And you think if you were Plato that these people would be philosopher kings, that they'd make the best set of decisions possible because they'd be perfectly rational. Instead, what you find is that these people become, a bit like me in the cereal aisle, they become pathologically indecisive. So they'll spend all day trying to figure out where to eat lunch or which pen to use or when they should set up an appointment to meet with their doctor. Trifling decisions become debilitating. And I think that speaks to the larger importance of these subtle emotional signals that even when we're not aware of the emotions, they really help drive our behavior. And I think Damasio's work has shown us that pure reason, this thing we've been lusting after for thousands and thousands of years, that's not a great thing. It's not something we should aspire to. Pure reason's actually a disease.
Thank you. On that note, Jonah, this has been so interesting. I want to thank you so much. Let's give a big hand to Jonah Lehrer for his thoughts here tonight. So thanks, Jonah. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.